Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All right, everybody, let's move along. Nothing to see here. Those last 2 weeks, just pretend they never really happened, all right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 16th of October. Good, as always, to have you with us. And fingers crossed, good to be able to say things are looking up in Washington, D.C., economy-wise. A deal does seem to be upon us, even though there is voting yet to do. Marketplace's David Gura is on the line from Washington, as he has been low these several weeks. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai, don't jinx it.
I know. Fingers crossed, right? So I have asked you this before. I will ask you perhaps again, although maybe this is the last time. Where are we? What's the state of play?
Okay, so I went to bed last night, and it was not on the early side. But the House deal had sort of fallen apart. We had rumors that there was a Senate deal in the works. We woke up this morning. In fact, the Senate says there was a deal, and around noon Washington time, the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid comes out onto the Senate floor with his good friend, as he puts it, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, and they present this proposal. And under that proposal, the government would reopen. There would be money to fund it through mid-January. Congress would raise the debt ceiling for a few months, and there would be yet another committee that would be charged with looking at budget issues, and they would have to hash something out, have a plan by mid-December.
All right. So, David, we got a piece of tape in. I want to play it for you and get your comments on this analysis. Go ahead. Pretty good, right? Can down the road, kicking it. We're doing this all over again in February, right? That's when the debt limit deal expires?
That's right. So, you know, I imagine there are a lot of people who are saying they can't bear to think of another round of this come February. I mean, I talked to Danny Blanchflower. He's an economist at Dartmouth College. And he said, you know, while this is a deal, it does solve the problems here for a while. It is fundamentally a short-term deal.
So we're seeing great uncertainty, and it really doesn't help to choose to extend that. So to come back and do this again in 3 months' time and again and again.
So, the hope here is that some of these politicians have been chastened by all of this. They've gotten the message from Wall Street, from investors, that, you know, you can't play games with things like the debt limit. But yes, there is a real likelihood that we could be back here in another couple of months having these same conversations.
Let me run a phrase by you here and get your reaction to it. The phrase is the Budget Control Act of 2012, also known as the sequester. That is part of this deal. Explain to us why it matters and where this budget committee for mid-December is going to take that conversation.
Yes, the sequester.
So it's those big budget cuts, right?
Yes, exactly. The automatic budget cuts. And so, as I said, there'd be money to fund the government through January 15th. And that is the day on which the next round of these automatic budget cuts, budget caps, are supposed to take effect. So the hope here is, in some corners of the Capitol, that with this new committee charged with looking at the budget and with that deadline, cooler heads would prevail and maybe those kind of blunt cuts would be made a little less blunt before that deadline hits.
Whatever happened to health care, by the way, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is that anywhere in this deal?
No, it's remarkable. I mean, the whole conversation a few weeks ago was about health care, and this group of Republicans in the House, a few in the Senate, really wanted to change that law. If you look at the contours of the proposal that we have here today, there are some really, really small changes to the law, but nothing anywhere like what we were looking at a couple of weeks back. So it's remarkable how much that's been moved to the side.
Let's say, just for instance, and we've only got just a little while left. Let's say, just for instance, something happens and it does not pass tonight. Can we go another day or two and have it be status quo?
Yeah, the consensus among those I talked to today is that probably that this deadline is so squishy because we don't know when bills are going to be due. We don't know what money's coming in the Treasury Department. That, you know, odds are that if we hit midnight and the Senate hasn't passed this, the House hasn't passed this, there still would be a little time left. Right. It'd be ideal if they did. But I think that there's some sense that we'd be all right for just a little while at least.
All right. David Gura in our Washington Bureau. If anything changes, by the way, David, we're going to call you back up. All right.
I'll be here. OK. Right, thanks, Kai.
A quick footnote, by the way, to the shutdown before we move on. At least we hope it's a footnote, past tense. The economists at Standard & Poor's came out with an estimate today of the costs of the shutdown, both in terms of gross domestic product and actual dollars. Here are the numbers. 0.6% worth of economic growth, which we can ill afford. $24 billion in dollars, some of which will be made up when things reopen, but still a whole lot of money. Speaking of reopening, by the way, we got back on the phone with Lisa Goldenberg this afternoon. She runs the Delaware Steel Company. We had her on last week talking about how the shutdown was hitting her. It still is, it turns out, and it's not just her either.
I was on the phone with several presidents just this morning of steel companies, and everyone's saying they're spending more time reading and trying to figure out what's going on than actually transacting.
Lisa Goldenberg at the Delaware Steel Company. So let's assume best case and assume things go as planned tonight. The government does open back up again tomorrow. What's that going to look like? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith did some calling around to find out.
What does it mean when the government reopens? That's a big question. For us out here, there will be a rush of claims.
Sylvia Kristen is a cattle rancher and the director for the South Dakota Stock Growers Association. The claims she's talking about are from a devastating storm that killed tens of thousands of cattle. Now thousands of ranchers are waiting to submit claims to the federal government for a partial reimbursement for their losses.
There are some ranchers that it will really be the difference between their small business being able to survive or not.
Dramas like this are playing out across the country as the shutdown puts people's lives on hold. And the problems won't vanish when the government reopens, says Max Steyer, head of the Partnership for Public Service.
It's going to be a mess. There's going to be a lot of work for a lot of people to untangle the last few weeks.
Mortgage applications, work permits, back pay for furloughed workers. Steyer says after the government reopens, people will have to wait weeks or even months to get the services they need. Meanwhile, the backlog will keep getting bigger.
There's real damage being done here.
Josh Bivens is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute.
There's a real loss of productivity both going into the shutdown and then another period of low productivity as you sort of ramp it all back up.
Bivens says this could permanently lower confidence in the U.S. economy, both for foreign investors and people just trying to get a mortgage application in. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, shutdown? Debt limit? What shutdown? What debt limit? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Chinese economy, as you may have heard, has slowed down just a little bit. But gross domestic product over there is still growing at a pretty good clip, an annual rate of 7% or so, which is pretty nice. But how are they doing that? How are they getting it done? At the local level, it's all about developing property, building commercially, mostly. Local governments across China the past several years have moved at least 40 million people out of their homes, selling that land to developers. Earlier this year, our China correspondent Rob Schmitz told us about a group of people in Shanghai who refused to be part of that economic equation. They managed to stay put in their homes for nearly a decade. But now time has run out. Here's Rob.
Early one Wednesday morning a few weeks ago, a group of men broke into the Shanghai home of 72-year-old Xie Guo Jen and her husband.
I had just woken up and was on the toilet when I heard them knock down the front door. Five men pushed open the bathroom door, gagged my mouth so I couldn't scream. And when I struggled, they pulled my arm so far behind my back, it felt that they had broken.
She was dragged downstairs, where she saw her 69-year-old husband tied up on the floor. The men threw the couple into the back of a van and drove them to an outdoor courtyard nearby, where they were kept the rest of the day.
When they released us, we ran back home to find our home had been demolished. All of my belongings, heirlooms, and family photos, gone. They had kidnapped us and robbed us of everything.
They were the government of Xuhui, a district in the heart of Shanghai. For years, the Xuhui government had tried to persuade people in this rundown neighborhood called Maggie Lane to leave their homes. Ye Mao is an analyst with the China Real Estate Information Center. He says the land, the size of a city block, is a potential gold mine.
If this land could be developed into a residential area, it would easily be among the most expensive properties in Shanghai.
In 2005, a developer hired by the Xuhui government set fire to a house in Maggie Lane. They were trying to scare people out of their homes. Instead, they burned an elderly couple alive in their bed. After that, the Xuhui government left the neighborhood alone. She and her husband were among a handful of people who stayed. But all that changed this week. Now Xie, who suffers from colon cancer, and her husband Chen have to find another home, much like tens of millions of others displaced by land grabs across China. Beijing property lawyer Wang Cailiang says here's the problem. China's GDP growth largely depends on local governments acquiring and then selling land.
In a normal system, the government is not supposed to be benefiting from land transactions. They should only be responsible for managing the land. They are not businessmen.
14 years ago, land sales made up just 9% of revenue for local governments. That skyrocketed to 64% just 2 years ago. Now, China's economic growth is dipping, and the central government has plans to move a quarter of a billion rural Chinese into the cities over the next decade. Wang says there is more pressure than ever on local government officials to take people's land by any means necessary.
In Chinese, we call it heichai. Illegal demolition. It's when governments hire mafia types to kidnap people or throw them into illegal prisons and then take their land. We're seeing more and more of this all over China.
Wang says the methods used in the Xuhui government's taking of Maggie Lane, kidnapping Xie and Chen from their home and then detaining them, violated Chinese law. The Xuhui government refused repeated requests for an interview with Marketplace. Instead, officials forwarded the request to Chinese state security officers, who then warned Marketplace to stop talking to Maggie Lane residents. Nearly a year ago, when Marketplace began covering this story, Xie and Chen, the couple who just lost their home, were optimistic. Xi Jinping had just become president, and he spoke about the Chinese dream, the idea that all Chinese get a fair shot at achieving their dreams.
The government talks about the Chinese dream, but there is no sense of happiness or dignity living in this society. It's all gone. There is no hope in this life.
Chen ends this thought with a question. The Chinese dream, he asks, shaking his head. Whose dream is that? In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Amazon just won a contract against IBM. The CIA will soon be running its operations on Amazon servers, a bookseller. And now they're running the government.
Man, you really can get everything there, can't you? But first, let's do the numbers. There you go. I knew it was going to be the really happy music. The Dow up 205 points today. 1.3% ended at 15,373. The NASDAQ rose 45 points, 1.2%. 38.39. The number of the S&P 500 gained 23 points, 1.3%, closed at 17.21. I love it when I guess the numbers music, right? Big banks rallied. Citigroup added 4% today. Bank of America gained 2%. J.P. Morgan Chase was up more than 3% as it agreed to a $100 million fine for manipulating markets in its gigantic London whale bet. The bank also, and this is a first, actually admitted its traders acted recklessly. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.67%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Obama is scheduled to meet with the Prime Minister of Italy at the White House. The United Nations observes the International Day for the Eradication of Poverty. And Elvis got some screen time with Memphis audiences during the premiere of Jailhouse Rock on October 17, 1957. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The RV crowd, the recreational vehicle crowd, has been taking it on the chin during the shutdown. Lots of national parks with their gates locked and campgrounds closed. But the roads overall are actually getting more crowded with motorhomes. Winnebago reports quarterly profits tomorrow. They're expected to be pretty good. And Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports that's about the economy and who's behind the wheel.
When I think of the RV industry, I think of Winnebagos. But Katherine Thompson, she's an analyst at the Thompson Research Group, she says something else comes to mind.
We've thought that the RV industry is a really good leading indicator for overall economic trends.
There's the obvious reason. Nobody really needs a motorhome, and they're not cheap. Thompson says RVs can cost between $10,000 for the bare bones variety and up to $300,000 for a fancy master bath, a full kitchen, and a widescreen TV. So when RV sales are up, we know that people have extra money and feel confident about spending it. David Whiston is an analyst at Morningstar.
It's been a very strong year, both for the industry and for Winnebago.
Whiston says motorhomes are up 35% this year, and for the past 4 years, sales have been climbing. There are a few things driving this trend. The economy is improving, banks are a little more willing to lend, and baby boomers haven't lost their taste for the road. In fact, they're passing it on.
We've seen a strong resurgence in RV activity, especially among the young families.
Mac Bryan is with the Recreation Vehicle Industry Association. He says it's not all wanderlust. Bryan says airports have become such a hassle, especially with young kids, that motorhoming is just more convenient. Plus, he says, once you buy the rig, an RV vacation can be much cheaper than paying for hotels, meals at restaurants, and other forms of family travel. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
So this is what you call a good segue coming out of a story about the prospects for Winnebago sales being up. The broader actual housing market is up as well. Prices have been climbing for a number of months now. And one place to see that recovery is in Oakland, California. But how the housing market there is doing is different from how the neighborhood is doing. Arthi Shahani took a walk through West Oakland.
Marilyn Williams got to West Oakland in 1983, and she hasn't left since. Williams takes me on a driving tour, starting with this row of Victorians.
Average age, 100 plus. My house was built, I'm still calling it my house. I'm so silly.
Silly because she doesn't own this white duplex anymore. She just rents the ground floor. In 2010, Williams fell behind on her mortgage payments. She was getting a divorce and lost her husband's income.
It wasn't like I just said, oh, I don't have the money. I'm not going to pay if I can't pay the whole thing. I actually started making half payments.
Her house went on short sale and sold for about one-third the price she'd bought it for. At that rate, she could have afforded to keep it, but her bank wouldn't write down her principal.
My loan was held by investors. And it was just being serviced, quote, serviced by a bank.
West Oakland is losing its black families. Williams is a teacher and longtime community activist, and she's trying to figure out if this is still her community. She points across the street to a 7-foot-tall mural of a young father and recalls the last time they spoke.
I gave him a big hug. His name is Cedric. And I said, I'm really proud of you.
The next day, Cedric was shot dead, the casualty in a crossfire. When the house with this mural was foreclosed, the new owners nearly painted over it.
And I flew out of the house screaming, no, you know, that mural has brought about a change in this whole community.
William says in the 1980s, West Oakland was a crack den, but drug dealing stopped at that corner. And the improvements continued. After a freeway collapsed in the 1989 earthquake, Williams organized to replace it with a tree-lined boulevard.
We got a beautifully landscaped corridor named after Nelson Mandela.
All this activism by Marilyn Williams is not the kind of metric that mattered to her bank, but it did make the neighborhood more inviting. We turn another corner and meet the new West Oakland.
You know, it's a neighborhood that is just screaming for everything.
Vladimir Levitansky used to be a clown in the circus. Now he's the owner of a new organic restaurant. His menu is starting with fish and chips and po' boys, but he plans to
slowly introduce crazy exotic food to the neighborhood, like carrots, something that was not deep fried.
In most ways, it's a healthy housing market recovery.
Jed Kulko is chief economist at the real estate company Trulia. I went to Kulko to get his expert take on Marilyn Williams. Is there any economic argument at all that the market loses when this community leader loses? Kulko begins to answer.
Sometimes what we see, what an individual's going through, is a clear sign of bigger problems in the macroeconomy.
He doesn't have the heart to finish his thought. Sometimes personal pain is a sign of systemic failure. But here, Kulko tells me later, it's not. William says West Oakland is not as tight-knit as it used to be. Tech geeks who were priced out of San Francisco have moved in.
A lot of them are introverts. You know, they're not getting out into the community and just walking and getting to know people.
Williams does recall one exception. A young blonde woman came by the other day looking to do volunteer work. Williams was so surprised, she gave her a hug. In West Oakland, I'm Aarti Shahani for Marketplace.
Amazon.com, online seller of books and a whole bunch of other things, as you know. It is, I think it's fair to say, a force, maybe the force in the retail economy today. Brad Stone writes for Bloomberg Business Week. He has spent time there and elsewhere covering Amazon and its founder, Jeff Bezos. His new book about the company and its culture and its boss is called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. Brad, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Kai.
There is a thread that runs through this book. You mention it early and you mention it often. It's part of Bezos's personality, I guess you would say. And since this is radio, we're gonna hit you with a little bit of it here, and then I want to talk about it. Jeff Bezos's laugh, you write, precedes him down the hallway. You hear it in meetings. It will come after a volcanic outburst of temper. I mean, it's this defining thing for him.
That's right. And it's unusual in a number of respects, one of which is he, and I've, of course, heard it in talking to him, he's not always laughing with you. It's sort of difficult to put your finger on. But one of his colleagues literally said, he's punishing you. And it's that his standards are so high, you know, and his intellect is so fierce, you know, that sometimes it's you're just not catching up with him. And that is what he finds funny.
Amazon is not, based on your telling of it, and honestly some conversations I've had with friends of mine, it is not a not always a pleasant place to work.
That is definitely true.
How is it sustainable then?
Well, I think it's by design that he makes it an uncomfortable place to work. I mean, he doesn't want it to be, you know, a country club for his employees. He wants everyone given, you know, the proverbial 110%. And it's why, frankly, a lot of people go to Amazon and leave after 2 years. But it also might be why this is a company that has achieved so much over the last two decades. It's interesting because we're very familiar, you know, with the Google lifestyle and what, you know, the kind of, it seems like a paradise. Amazon's more a retailer in that respect, you know, or at least an interesting blend between a retailer and a technology company.
You say, and I agree with you, that he has changed the world. And he's done that just with Amazon.com, the retail shopping site, and he's changed our behavior. But there are a couple of things that sort of have come from that that arguably have changed the world even more. The first is Amazon Web Services, this idea of us all living in the cloud, which now we take for granted, started with Bezos and Amazon in some degree.
Incredibly, because this is an e-commerce business.
Yeah.
And this is what Bezos does so well. He took this totally separate idea, kind of extracted the DNA, brought it into Amazon, and started what we now know of as Amazon Web Services.
And other companies, I mean, Netflix is maybe the most famous. They use Amazon Web Services. We're all up in the cloud now. I mean, this whole idea is Web 2.0 now. It's the future.
The CIA is now running. You know, Amazon just won a contract against IBM. The CIA will soon be running its operations on Amazon servers, a bookseller. And now they're running the government. It's
Think
remarkable.
Think about that for a minute. True confessions time. I am a loyal customer of Amazon Prime. This idea that you pay, I don't even know what it is, $70 a year and you get free shipping and overnight shipping and all this stuff. I mean, it makes it really easy to buy stuff off of Amazon.
It turns you into an Amazon addict. And the interesting thing is, you know, Bezos is building a whole separate business atop Amazon Prime. So as you know, you get access to free Kindle books.
Right.
You get to stream movies.
Yep.
I think it's a little Costco in a way, mm-hmm. buried inside Amazon. You know, Costco has this business model where you have to pay to shop there. A good business if you can get it. And now the same is true with Amazon. You're paying $79 a year for the luxury of spending even more money and all of these add-on services.
Now you're making me feel stupid, man.
Well, I pay it too, Kai.
There is a word here that has to be said about, and this is going to sound harsh, but when you think about it, it makes sense. He is ruthless in his business dealings. He wants to win. He wants to get the customers. He wants to offer the lowest price, and he wants market share, almost whatever it takes.
That's right. And what he would say is that Amazon is ruthless in pursuit of, you know, pleasing its customers. And what his critics would say is that, you know, it's ruthless about gaining power and fame. And, you know, the interesting thing about a complex company like Amazon is that really both are true. And, you know, it's what makes it such an interesting story.
The book by Brad Stone is called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. It's a good read. Brad, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that the government may still be shut down, but the Federal Reserve waits for no one. The Fed came out with its regular regional review of the economy today, the Beige Book, it's called, because it is actually beige. Anyway, one little tidbit to share, just because I thought it was an interesting insight into the specificity with which the American economy is measured. And I'm just going to read verbatim here from the Fed. Here's the quote. South Dakota hotels noted that fall reservations by hunters decreased due to a report that the number of pheasants in the state was down. So now you know. We need like the pheasant index or something. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 205.1 and a third percent. There is a deal in the offing. The NASDAQ gained 45 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 up 23 points, 1.3%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. Have a good night. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.